Don't talk to strangers. From January 1st, 1976 through March 16th, 1977, 9 children in the Detroit area were murdered. Some were assaulted in their homes, others plucked off the streets, all of them found dead. If you have not yet listened to previous episodes, please go back and start there. We will be waiting for you. In our last episode, we discussed North Fox Island and the organized pedophile rings operating in Michigan, Tennessee, and Georgia. How these criminals worked together to procure children to assault, how they used their positions as teachers, religious leaders, and people of means for their own selfish ends at the expense of children. That the worst of these offenders, Dyer Grossman and Francis Sheldon, were able to evade capture and go on living their lives for decades after their evil deeds were uncovered. This week, we return to the case of Timothy King of Birmingham. He was last seen at the Hunter Maple Pharmacy, just a few blocks from his home, on the evening of March 16, 1977. When Tim disappeared, police reacted immediately. There were no delays, no excuses of runaways, no flip comments about not having had a kidnapping in the community in years. To their credit, the Birmingham police immediately set to work looking for Tim. The newly formed task force focused on his case. We now know that their efforts were likely misplaced, focusing on the blue Gremlin vehicle that Tim was seen near the night of the 16th. And I've heard that since the blue Gremlin was the focus, officers were pulling over every single blue Gremlin they could find, questioning the driver and searching the car. The scene along Woodward Avenue, the busy thoroughfare that cuts through both South Oakland County and the very heart of this story, Woodward was chaotic as cars were pulled over without cause, just so officers could look for Tim, or look for links back to the case. In a way, I don't blame them. It was the only lead they had. And seeing a photo of Tim with his sweet smile, or knowing what happened to Jill Robinson along I-75, or the sad scenes where Mark Stebbins and Christine Mihalik were left on the side of the road, those were never far from the thoughts of those in law enforcement. The task force wanted to catch the person responsible for these murders, and they worked out a strategy. Based on previous cases, they thought that between 11 p.m. and 3 a.m., Saturday into Sunday night, the killers would try and leave Tim's body on the side of the road. What if they placed officers with radios at a targeted selection of intersections, put the officers in their personal vehicles with walkie-talkies to look for suspicious cars or the elusive blue Gremlin, and when the kidnapper appears, grab them? It seemed like a great plan. Officers and cadets were happy to volunteer for this duty. Imagine if you were the guy, and let's face it, in 1977, most of these officers were men. If you were the guy who caught OCCK, the worst boogeyman the community had ever seen, if you could be the guy who not only caught him, but brought Tim King home to his family, to his parents, Marion and Barry, his older siblings, Mark, Chris, and Kathy. I'm certain that more than one officer dreamed of apprehending the killer or killers and bringing a sense of safety and security back not only to the community, but to their own home and children. So on Saturday night, they left their departments, pulling away from stations in Southfield and Berkeley, from Madison Heights and Farmington Hills. They drove to their assigned spot and waited. They watched. Their nerves were taut with anxiety, and their eyes tracked vehicles that went past. Perhaps they slumped a little in the seat to avoid being seen, hoping their car, perhaps an old Ford or a newer Chevy, would blend in, like it being parked there on the street was totally natural and normal. And then they waited. There were many intersections marked. One of them was along Squirrel Road in Bloomfield Hills. Another, at the other end of Oakland County, was at Gill Road, near 8 Mile, which is also known as Baseline Road. An 8 Mile, or Baseline, divided Farmington Hills from Livonia and divided Wayne County from Oakland. Now, what I'm going to tell you next is a story I've heard from a couple of different people. A young officer from Farmington Hills. He may have even been a cadet at the time. He was placed in a car on Gill Road near 8 Mile. He knew his assignment. He knew the gravity of the situation. He was young, but he was bright, and he would go places in his career. He sat in his car on Gill Road for hours, waiting, watching, taking notice as cars passed by. He got a radio call from the station. They were calling him off. He should leave the intersection and return to the department. I don't know if he questioned the reason for moving him or if he protested, but he was a responsible young man, and when command asked him to do something, he complied, starting up the car and heading north, back to the station as requested. It would be an hour or two later that a car, driven by an unknown person, drove past the location where the young officer was parked earlier. The car slowed to a stop and the door opened. The driver, or perhaps his passenger, unloaded something from the car, dumping it on the side of Gill Road, just south of 8 Mile. Then he reached back into the car and picked up a skateboard, an orange skateboard, with the edge a little roughed up from where it had crashed into a low brick wall a couple of days earlier. He put the skateboard next to the body of the little boy, and then he got back in the car, and it drove away. When a couple of kids, guys in their teens or early 20s, spotted the boy and his skateboard on the side of Gill Road an hour or so later, Tim's body was still warm. When first responders, likely officers from Livonia, who were soon followed by officers from Farmington Hills and Birmingham and Ferndale and Berkeley, and then the big blue cruisers driven by the Michigan State Police, when those first officers arrived, they started working on Tim. It was a cool spring night. There was snow on the ground. But Tim's body was still warm, and they were hopeful. They didn't want Tim to be dead, so they tried. They had kids of their own at home, boys who wore nylon sports jackets like the one Tim was wearing, kids who wore Levi's and rode skateboards and walked to the store for candy and chewing gum. They tried to revive Tim, but Timothy King could not be saved. Timothy King would be the last confirmed victim of the as-yet-unidentified Oakland County child killer. With Tim no longer missing, investigators went to work with the evidence they had on hand, trying to learn what they could about the person or persons who murdered Tim King and left him on Gill Road. One of the things that they did was appear at the elementary and middle schools located just half a mile north of the location where Tim's body was left. These schools, Gill Elementary and Power Middle School, are still in operation today. And on Monday morning, officers and investigators were on site, talking to kids and parents, in part to reassure them that their children were safe, but also to find out if anyone saw or heard anything the night Tim was left. Many local families were interviewed by the task force because of the proximity of their home to the location where Tim's body was left. Investigators were eager to talk to them, to see if there was a connection to that location, if there was a reason Tim was left there. And I spoke with someone who lived in one of those houses, one that was close enough to the crime scene to warrant an interview. And she has asked to remain anonymous, but wants to share her clear memories of them at her house, of a young L. Brooks Patterson talking not only to her father, but speaking to her and her brothers about the case, asking if they, the children, had seen anything or heard anything that might help investigators. And she told them that something had happened, something that scared her, that she knew something was wrong, and finally police were there to hear her concerns. I will let her tell the story in her own words.
The week of March 14th, 1977, can you tell me where you were living?
Yeah, we were living in the Gill Road and 9 Mile area, so Farmington Hills.
That week, there was a boy that went missing from Birmingham named Timmy King, and that story was all over the news.
Yes, and I recall it. I recall that the boy was missing, and he was. There were news broadcasts nightly on TV that we saw. It was the week of my birthday, and it was because we had already heard of other missing children at that time, and children that had been killed and abducted, and we were all on high alert, I think, in the area. Oakland County families were all really scared, and it did change how we were as children and how we played, and I saw these news broadcasts and thought, and even said out loud that I had hoped that this boy for my birthday would come home and be safe and be okay. So I remember it clearly, that he was missing. Did not realize that he had been discovered in the area of where we lived, very close. In fact, on the street in which we walked to and from school every day is where they found him. And I didn't realize that initially until probably a visit. We had a visit from police officers that were investigating in the area and talking to everyone, and they came to our house. I think that that's the first time that I really understood that he had been found and was not alive, was when they came to our house.
And where he was found was in very close proximity to an elementary school and a middle school, in addition to being in proximity to your home.
It was, and we went to school, we attended that elementary school. It was a dirt road then. We all walked on that dirt road, and it was, oiled in the summertime. It was a very dusty dirt road. A lot of houses there, definitely a dense community in terms of children and families. There were fields where he was found. There were some empty field areas there, but on Gill Road itself by the elementary school and the middle school, it was pretty densely populated. And we walked to and from school and played on those roads. There was a creek in front of the elementary school that we all gathered and played in the summertime. Although in March, I think at that time, if I remember, there was a lot of snow on the ground that year. So we were trenching through the snow to go to the school.
And the morning after Tim was found, because he was found sort of in the small hours, law enforcement and other members of the community, we know now that was the task force, they were at the school, and they were talking to kids and to families.
Yeah, and I recall the men that asked, I did have some police officers, although I didn't identify them directly. They weren't in police uniforms. The men that I spoke with as a child were in suits.
Plain clothes.
Detectives. Mm-hmm. They were not in police uniforms, and they were asking all of us if we had seen anything in the area, if anything seemed unusual, if we had seen any cars. And I was at that point taking a bus to school. And every morning I do remember reporting to the police officers when they asked if we had seen anything, because every morning as I stood out at my bus stop alone, there was a white box truck that would come by every day. It was unmarked, and this man who was by himself in this truck, driving the truck every day, would slow way down very slowly in front of my bus stop and wave at me. In the first couple of days, I instinctively sort of waved back, and then I became very uncomfortable, and I stopped waving, and I would see the truck come, and I would turn my back towards the truck so that he couldn't get my attention or that he wouldn't see me. And so I told, and this had been happening, not for an extended period of time, maybe a week or two, and I told the police officers that there was that happening in the morning. And the men brushed it off and said, I don't think that's who we're looking for, and did suggest that perhaps my bus stop be changed out of the view of my house at that bus stop. I was at the corner.
So you're a little girl by herself at a bus stop, and a man is repeatedly stopping his vehicle sort of in the middle of the road, not like at a stoplight or a stop sign.
Slowing way down, very slow. He didn't entirely stop, and he never hollered out the window, but he did slow down to just a creeping past.
Yeah. And they told you that wasn't who they were looking for.
Yeah. One of them then turned to the other and said, I don't think that's who we're looking for.
Do you know?
It's the end of the conversation, or the end of the questions for me.
They never followed up, as far as you know, on this individual?
Not as far as I know. I do know that my bus stop was changed by the school district, so that was in eye line of our house. I don't believe there was any other follow-up, at least it wasn't with me. They never came back and interviewed me again.
Wow. Okay. And when, I know that you and I have spoken about this previously, but when the plainclothes officers and other representatives from the task force were at your house or at the school, I believe you said that L. Brooks Patterson was one of the people that was on site?
Yeah, I didn't know who he was at the time, but I recognized him or understood and heard his name pretty soon thereafter because he was in the news a lot and he was in the newspapers and we heard his name and saw his face. So I was able to identify that that's who he was. And I think that he was with the task force when they were at the school or doing interviews in that area pretty quickly after Timmy was found.
Okay. Did they make any changes aside from changing your bus stop, having Tim's body found not only so close to where you were living, but so close to a very student-centered area with the two schools there? Did you recall any changes taking place at or around the school during that time?
No, in terms of security or safety, nothing like that. It was business as usual. I think parents were certainly frightened, and we had to check in more often, and that, I think, became a pretty standard practice for most of the families in that area, if not all over Oakland County. But the school, the children that were assigned safeties that would stand on sidewalks and at the street directing kids in the morning and the afternoons, none of that behavior changed. All of those kids still perform those safety duties, and I wasn't at the time, I was too young, so I wasn't doing that at the time, but nothing changed other than I believe they changed a lot of the walking student status to busing required if they were further away from the school. I think they changed the distance in which you had to live in order to be a bus child. It became shorter.
Okay.
I don't know what it was, a mile to a half mile or something like that. That's the only change that I remember.
Do you remember if they did any assemblies or if anyone came and spoke at the school after that?
I did not.
Because that, where he was found, as you know, was less than half a mile from the school or about half a mile from the school.
Yes. And that was a time in the, and I don't know when Farmington Hills started the program, if it was Oakland County or Farmington Hills, but they had the hand, blue hand.
Yes.
In the window.
Yes. The helping hand.
Helping hand safe home. And that was something that took off. And I recall having conversations, and hearing about that program in houses all over our neighborhood, putting those helping hand signs up in their windows, including our own home. We had one in our window for a very long time, but that was the only thing that I recall or any conversations that we had, and they did not tie that directly to what was happening with the Oakland County child killings. They simply just said that they had this program and we could pick up these signs and houses and put them in our windows. And that's where we should go if we felt unsafe. We should find one of those hands. So now we know that none of those were background checks.
No, I actually found those. I think I talked about it in an earlier episode. I found those hands so creepy and unsettling.
Yeah, I think that was the natural response. And they weren't checking to make sure that the people that had those in their windows were safe.
Right. They weren't vetted homes.
No. But that became a part of post-Oakland child killing life in our community.
And
that stands out as something that was a big deal.
And I don't know how much people who were born like immediately after that understand how much things shifted after 1977.
They did, and as children, for sure. I mean, we didn't play outside without thinking about the dangers of strangers. That was a repeat message, stranger danger. And I don't know that it was it was a message that was repeated to us frequently, but I don't know that there were real solid plans for preventing or keeping kids safe, preventing this from happening. I don't know if there were programs for that. It was simply, let's pass the message on to the kids and the families that this is what's happening and this is what can happen, and everybody needs to keep a lookout and be safe. But it did change. It changed how we played. It changed how safe we felt. And, families were frightened.
Yeah.
We were frightened.
Yeah, kids.
And Timothy became a significant part of my childhood and what I remember in terms of, you know, how safe we were or weren't as kids.
Yeah, it was all much closer than I think we realized.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely was.
To me, one of the most frustrating things is that her concerns about the man who was driving by her at the bus stop each day, a young man driving a white workman's truck, is that he was immediately dismissed as not of interest. There was no follow-up. They could have had someone watch the stop, take down his plate, or pull him over to make certain he wasn't a person of interest in the case. Instead, the responsibility for her safety was placed back on her, a child in a vulnerable position, alone at a bus stop. I wonder how many leads like this were overlooked by the task force. How many creepers were left on the street as they chased their suspect or suspects and disregarded those who could be guilty of other crimes? In the days after Tim's body was found, the King family was understandably in shock. This wasn't supposed to happen. Not to Tim, not to anyone. Tim was gone. His kidnapping, his captivity, and his death. All the worst sorts of nightmare fuel. As the family prepared to bury him, to say goodbye to their kid brother, Tim's sister, Kathy, wanted to find a blue tracksuit, the clothing he told her he was saving his money for. She wanted him to be able to wear it at his funeral. So Kathy and a friend of her father's set out, driving from store to store, looking for the clothes Tim wanted. Time and again, they found blue tracksuits, but they weren't right. They were the wrong color, or far too big for Tim's small frame. At autopsy, the coroner noted that Timothy King was just over 4 feet tall and weighed about 60 pounds. He really was just a little boy. And as the pair shopped, everything they came across was too big, or the wrong color. Kathy went home, defeated. Her father's friend kept looking and finally located the tracksuit, a powder blue tracksuit in a size that would fit Tim. Kathy shares this story in far more detail on her blog, and I will post a link in the show notes. While the King family is arranging a funeral, Tim is autopsied in Wayne County. Because his body was left south of 8 Mile Road, he was examined not by the Oakland County coroner, but by Dr. Werner Spitz. Spitz, the German-born pathologist, was 50 years old when Timothy King arrived on his table, an experienced examiner. If Dr. Spitz's name is familiar to you, he consulted on the O.J. Simpson trial, the Kayleigh Anthony case, and JonBenet Ramsey, among others. Spitz noted a small mark on Tim's forehead, but didn't make much of it. Unfortunately, that small mark, whatever it was, swelled, and at the funeral, Tim's forehead was misshapen under the cosmetics the mortician had carefully applied to his face. Tim's cause of death was listed as smothering, and, just like with Mark Stebbins, his small body showed signs of repeated sexual abuse. Evidence was collected at autopsy, including multiple pubic hairs that did not belong to Tim. Those hairs were tested, and only a mitochondrial DNA match, one that remains elusive, was possible. The quality of the DNA found on Tim's body and the quality of the DNA available in the Oakland County child murders is not sufficient for GEDmatch. This is incredibly unfortunate and frustrating, and yet another reason that this case, this frustrating, maddening case, remains unsolved. The task force decided they needed to prepare the King family for the funeral. Tim's funeral mass would be held at Holy Name Catholic Church in Birmingham. A priest from St. Alan's Parish in Troy, the King family's former church, would also be on hand for the service. And remember, we've heard that Jill Robinson sometimes attended religious services at St. Alan's Church, just like the King family. As the task force prepared the family for the funeral, they cautioned the Kings not to show any emotion. The task force didn't want them tearful or emotional at the funeral of a murdered 11-year-old. Can you imagine? Yes, we know that your youngest child was tortured for days, repeatedly raped, and then murdered and dumped in the gutter, but please, no tears. The task force hoped to provoke a reaction from the killer or killers. The funeral would be attended by a mix of uniformed and plainclothes officers. They also had photographers taking pictures of the crowds, snapping photo after photo of those who arrived to pay their respects to the murdered child. Afterward, they developed the photos and pored over them, hoping to spot someone who didn't belong, see a face that was someone they perhaps had on their radar in the investigation. The Kings did as they were told. They swallowed their grief and sat stone-faced at Tim's funeral. And the police took down pictures and wrote down license plate numbers, and none of it mattered. Tim's murder would go unpunished. His killer would not be captured. The King family found themselves in a group with the Robinsons, the Allens, the Bishops, the Stebbins, and the Mihalik families. No arrest, no answer, no closure. We are no closer today in 2019 than we were in 1977. We don't know who murdered these kids, and we cannot understand why the killer or killers got away with it. I think that what was shared with us this episode, and what Chris King told us, this commitment to the wrong answer, to the wrong path, this was a big part of the problem. The willingness to focus on the blue gremlin when the dented Pontiac Le Mans was a better answer. The willingness to look away from a creeper at a little girl's bus stop rather than taking him off the street. And the task force, the same people that told the Kings they could not grieve publicly the death of their 11-year-old son and brother. The task force will continue, with generous funding, for another 15 months after Tim's murder. They will close up shop in 1978. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of man-hours, for nothing. And one theme will emerge. One thread will be pulled again and again in the press in the months and years after Tim's murder. That the killer is either dead or institutionalized. Joe Kreese, the Michigan State Police liaison for the task force, mentions this time and again. In 1981, as the Atlanta child killings are under investigation, and yes, law enforcement in Michigan sent people to Atlanta to help their investigation, Joe Kreese said in a March 1981 news story that he believes the Oakland County child killer was dead or in an institution. He would tell the press, quote, "I don't think the psychological makeup of the killer or killers in Atlanta compares to the killers here either." Kreese said he believes the Oakland County child killer is dead or institutionalized. That was the line time and again. Tim King's sister, Catherine, in her blog on the investigation, has a post from July 15, 2018, where she quotes law enforcement time and again, dead or institutionalized, dead or institutionalized. Well, that description fits two of our suspects, or it did as of late November 1978, because at that point, Christopher Bush is dead, and his good friend, Greg Green, was in prison. We will talk more about what became of Christopher Bush, as well as another suspicious death associated with this case, in the next episode of Don't Talk to Strangers. And listeners, I'd like to mention, my work on this project has slowed considerably as my father was recently diagnosed with a terminal illness. I have done my best to stick to a schedule, but I have fallen short. I intend to have the next episode out before May 15th, 2019. If you would like more information on this case, please visit our website at dttspodcast.com. That's dttspodcast.com. Don't Talk to Strangers is a production of Spective Podcasts. I'm Nina Instead, the writer and voice behind Don't Talk to Strangers. I appreciate you listening, and please, be safe.